I think it's appropriate to begin this video with a thank you to all the staff and researchers at the Kamioka Observatory. Not only were they kind enough to allow me to use some of their footage, but as we'll see, they've achieved incredible things over the past few decades and truly deserve recognition. A couple of videos back, I briefly mentioned the cascade failure at the Super Kamiokande facility in Japan, and then I didn't elaborate further. Unsurprisingly, I got a lot of requests for a follow-up video. Now, this isn't a topic that needs one of my typical hour-long videos with flashy graphics and tailored visualizations. So, while I recover from the marathon that was my previous video, I thought it'd be nice to do a shorter and simpler video on this incident. Consider it a New Year's special, even though I'm probably going to release it about a week after New Year's Day. The failure at the Super Kamiokande is almost like an engineering disaster from a fairy tale. No one was hurt, no one went to jail. It's not well known in the West, so it almost sounds like a made-up cautionary tale. It did cost some taxpayer money, and I imagine grants were cancelled and researchers were delayed getting PhDs and the like. On the off chance that any of those researchers are listening, I'm sorry for saying your disaster was a fairy tale. But in the end, the facility was upgraded and not only functions to this day, but is currently being rebuilt into an even larger and more capable facility. It's quite difficult to see how it could have been predicted without the gift of hindsight, so it serves as an excellent case study for engineers today. Yet, it's probably the most physically spectacular catastrophic failure I can name off the top of my head. So gather round and take heed, because today we're going to visit the test chamber and learn all about cascade failures. The Super Kamiokande is a neutrino detector. As we shall see, it was, and still is, a truly groundbreaking facility. However, I barely know what a neutrino is. When we put all the various domains of science and engineering onto a spectrum of how much does Alex know about this field, particle physics appears right at the I know basically nothing end. So, any particle physicists watching, please just put your fingers in your ears for the next couple of minutes. I did study elementary particles very briefly during A-level physics, that's when I was about 17 years old, and that's about all I've ever covered on the topic. I remember these things, and I remember a thing called the Standard Model, which lists all the fundamental particles. Since I'm releasing this as a kind of special episode, let's have a little fun. Let's see how much of it I can remember from memory. So, there's my Alex Hall Standard Model from memory, based off a couple of physics lessons from almost 20 years ago, and occasionally seeing it mentioned on PBS Spacetime. So, at this point in writing the script, I actually went off and watched this brilliant video, which explained the Standard Model, and here's how it actually looks. Cool, I guess I got some of it right. Mostly wrong, but anyway. Right, let's talk about neutrinos. Neutrinos are barely detectable in our universe. That is because they only interact with the gravitational and weak nuclear forces. What is the weak nuclear force? I don't really know, but it doesn't matter for the purpose of this video. Famously, this means trillions upon trillions of them pass straight through the Earth every second without even slowing down. But very, very, very occasionally, they'll interact with a particle in the Earth. If a neutrino just happens to pass close enough to an electron, it can transfer some of its energy via the weak force and accelerate that electron to a speed faster than the speed of light in whatever medium is present. Side note, that does not make anything go faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. That is impossible. When that happens, the electron emits a minuscule flash of light. This is called Cherenkov radiation, and is the same effect that causes the blue glow seen in certain circumstances around a nuclear reactor. And that is how you detect a neutrino. And more importantly, detecting that tiny flash is an engineering problem, so I can confidently re-enter the discussion again. Back in the 1970s, a team at the University of Tokyo came up with a pretty audacious plan. Number 1. Fill a huge tank with 50,000 tons of extremely pure water. Number 2. Surround it with unimaginably sensitive detectors that can detect that tiny flash of light on the rare occasion a neutrino triggers an event in the tank. Now, there were two major problems that needed solving to make this a reality. Problem 1. Just building a tank at the surface would lead to an endless supply of false detections. The problem is cosmic rays. These hit our upper atmosphere continually. We're shielded from them by the atmosphere. But that doesn't mean nothing makes it to the ground. Relevant to the overall theme of this video, cosmic rays striking particles in the upper atmosphere lead to cascade events, causing many different types of particles to rain down on the surface of Earth. Of the greatest concern are muons, which can penetrate some distance into the surface. These would also strike electrons in the tank and lead to false detection events. So, the Super Kamiokande is buried 1,100 metres below the surface, inside Mount Ikino, to shield it from incoming particles. I may not fully understand the genius of particle physics as a field, but I appreciate the engineering of the tools they use. This is serious stuff. Problem 2. How do you detect a flash of light on the order of a single photon in a 50,000 ton tank of water? And detecting is not enough. We want multiple detections so we can determine the trajectory of the particle that caused it. Many viewers will already know the answer, because the technology to do that has been around for decades. Those who don't, the answer may be slightly surprising. We use vacuum tubes. Photomultipliers, to be precise. Now, photomultipliers are fascinating, in part because they're one of very few classes of vacuum tubes still in production and widespread use today. No solid-state equivalent has yet been invented that can outperform a photomultiplier across all of its design specs. Let's see how they work. At the top of the tube is a photocathode. This is a plate of material that ejects electrons when struck by photons. For those paying attention, I just described the photoelectric effect. It's how photovoltaic solar panels work. Incoming photons knock electrons from the surface. In the case of a solar panel, that flow of electrons is an electric current. But in our case, we may only receive a single photon, which we wish to somehow detect. The single electron it knocked out of the plate needs somehow amplifying, so a charged electrode guides it to the first of a series of charged plates. The first plate may be at, say, positive 50 volts, so it attracts the electron, which strikes it at high speed and ejects more electrons. These are then accelerated to the next plate, which is at a higher voltage, say 100 volts. So these electrons strike that plate and knock out even more electrons. This process repeats down the chain, with more and more electrons being ejected each time. And note, this is another example of a cascade occurring. And we haven't even got to the big cascade that this video is actually about. After the final plate, the now millions of ejected electrons strike the anode and will register as a current pulse, therefore allowing us to detect a single photon which initiated the cascade. Now, the photomultiplier tubes used at the Super Kamiokande are no normal photomultipliers. Prior to their construction, the largest photomultipliers available in the West were about 20 centimetres in diameter. Those in the Super Kamiokande are a whopping 50 centimetres in diameter, and they are truly objects of beauty. I mean, just look at that thing. Manufactured by Hamamatsu, the model R3600 tube is not only extremely sensitive, but has a collection area larger than any other tube on the market. These line the interior walls of the tank, giving the Super Kamiokande its distinctive appearance. Most photos of the facility are taken under orange sodium vapour lamps. These are used during maintenance to avoid damaging those sensitive tubes. Also, note the little boat used during maintenance. There's something beautifully Japanese about that. Now, these tubes are rated to 8 atmospheres of external pressure. With a max possible water depth of 36 metres in the facility, that gives a safety margin of more than 2 for hydrostatic pressure. Hydrostatic. Static. Moving on. These tubes were first manufactured for the smaller Cameo Candy experiment. And this was, as I've already mentioned, wildly successful, performing many neutrino detections and also detecting a supernova via neutrinos, earning a Nobel Prize in the process. Super Cameo Candy came online in 1996 and contained 11,146 of these photomultiplier tubes, each with a cost of $10,000. Now that's not cheap in real terms, but I can't help but feel $10,000 is a bit of a bargain for a custom blown 50cm glass tube just like that. Of course, having to fork out for 11,000 of them would be a bit of a different matter. It's a good job they were designed to last the lifetime of the experiment and would only need to be purchased once, right? Anyway, with all my foreshadowing in place and a good picture of the physical configuration of the detector, we're finally ready to skip forward to the day of the disaster. Everything in this chapter and the next is taken from the official report published on the University of Tokyo website. Now, I do actually suspect there may be newer material in Japanese-only sections. I've not been able to find anything. If any Japanese-speaking viewers want to add anything in the comments, do go ahead and I'll pin a comment with any additions. Anyway, on the 12th of November 2001, the tank of the detector was being refilled following an extended period of maintenance. The water level had reached about 75% of the height of the tank, and the detector was outputting data as normal. Suddenly, at 11 a.m, two staff on site felt violent shaking and a roaring sound, which lasted for about 10 seconds. Air was felt rushing through the facility, and a seismometer 8.8 kilometres from the site recorded a seismic event lasting for about 5 seconds. The on-site staff immediately shut down power to the photomultipliers and checked the tank for leaks, of which none were found. Two staff descended to the water surface and discovered many of the visible photomultipliers below the water surface were broken. A few hours later, a camera was lowered into the tank, and following full surveys, it was discovered, I imagine with absolute dismay, that virtually all of the photomultiplier tubes below the surface were broken. 6,665 in total, out of the 11,146 installed in the detector. That's nearly $7 million in tubes destroyed in less than 10 seconds.
I neglected to mention earlier, but there's also an outer detector with 1,885 20cm tubes on the outer wall of the tank. 881 of those were also damaged in this incident.
Again, I stress no one was hurt. And I don't think a large number of people really suffered any lasting reputational harm due to this incident. But what on earth happened? Let's find out. As part of the maintenance works when the tank was empty, styrofoam boards were placed directly on top of the photomultipliers on the floor of the facility. Staff were able to walk on these boards, which would distribute the load and theoretically prevent damage to the tubes. However, in hindsight, it's theorised that the repeated movements of staff may have caused fatigue stress in some of the tubes, weakening them. This led to one tube in particular, tube 10,810, near the edge of the detector, experiencing a reduction in its failure stress to below that of the hydrostatic pressure of the water above it. Now, that single tube failing in isolation wouldn't be a huge deal. There were more than 11,000 of the things present in the detector. But it didn't fail in isolation. Let's talk about underwater implosions, something which I suddenly seem to be becoming an expert in since I've started this channel.
A quick interjection here. These animations are highly simplified, but communicate the general idea. I'm going to show collapsing vacuum bubbles apparently rebounding. That may seem unintuitive, but it does actually happen. Search for videos of cavitation bubbles if you want to see some examples. The dynamics are highly complex though and not relevant for this video. In fact, the rebound effect is not even relevant here. I'd just anticipate a lot of comments about it.
A vacuum tube imploding underwater is a particularly violent scenario. Let's imagine one imploding in air first. As the outer envelope fails, air rushes in to fill the gap, but is compressed as it does so. Eventually, there'll come a point where the compressive force is too great and the air rebounds outwards, forming a shockwave. Hamamatsu even drop-tested their tubes to ensure this shockwave wouldn't send glass shards flying out of the packaging if one was damaged during transit. But the point to note here is that air is highly compressible, which means the shockwave is not only spread out over time as the air is compressed and recovers, but also its energy is dissipated as it travels through the air. Now picture the same scenario, but with water as the working fluid. The water rushes in to fill the gap, but water is much, much less compressible than air. In the case of the Super Kamiokande, water at about 4 atmospheres of pressure rushed in from all sides and then rapidly, essentially slams into itself. With little compressibility to absorb all that energy, the shockwave is going to be much more brief. But let's just assume our tube in air also failed at 4 atmospheres. That means the total energy output here is the same. So if the energy output happens in a shorter period of time, that means the area under our shockwave curve must still be the same as it was for the tube in air. The only way to ensure the energy is the same, therefore the area is the same, is for the peak pressure to be higher. Now, how high was this peak pressure? The tubes were almost touching, so there was about 25 centimetres between the centre of each one and the edge of the next. Simulations performed shortly after the incident predicted a peak pressure at that distance of, deep breath, 30 megapascals! That's nearly 300 atmospheres! Well in excess of the 8 atmosphere design stress of the tubes. Though I must stress that 8 atmospheres was for a static uniform stress around the tube. Anyway, the imploding photomultiplier triggered a shockwave which easily exceeded the design stress of the 8 tubes around it, causing those to implode. And then they triggered all of their adjacent tubes to implode. This repeated in a cascade until there were barely any tubes underwater left. The whole process took less than 10 seconds and only terminated when the shockwaves were disrupted by the air-water interface. Now, the first question most people will be asking is, was a cascade failure anticipated? And the answer is yes. Back in 1981, before the photomultipliers were installed in the original Kamiokande, 6 were submerged in 1 metre of water and 1 was deliberately shattered. The surrounding 5 tubes did not shatter, so it was concluded a cascade failure was not possible. Now, look at the locations of the smash detectors in Super Kamiokande. Note, the only ones below the waterline to survive were within 3 metres of the water surface. Whether it was the reduced pressure or the presence of the air-water interface to disperse the shockwave, the disaster showed that a chain reaction would only be initiated below a depth of a few metres. Unfortunately, the design engineers missed this nuance and falsely believed they'd demonstrated a cascade failure was not possible as the water would not transmit enough energy between the tubes. The lesson here is when carrying out destructive testing, you need to carry it out in conditions as similar as possible to the actual use case. In keeping with me calling this a fairy tale disaster, the story does, in my opinion, have a happy ending. In fact, the story of Super Kamiokande is continuing to be written. Following the disaster, the surviving detectors were repositioned around the tank to allow for continued operation of the facility, albeit at a lower resolution than before. In 2006, replacement photomultipliers were fitted, and this restored the detector to its previous capacity. The tubes were also fitted with acrylic screens to break up a shockwave from an imploding tube and hopefully prevent a repeated cascade failure. And the Super Kamiokande has operated ever since. It detects about 30 neutrinos per day, which is far higher than I thought possible. Really fascinating stuff. It has a really, really nice website, which I thoroughly recommend visiting. You can even see live data from all of the 11,000 photomultipliers. In 2015, physicist Takaki Kajita was awarded the Nobel Prize for his work at Super Kamiokande in discovering neutrino oscillations. As I understand, this demonstrated that neutrinos have mass.
All right, I couldn't remain ignorant on that. So the day before releasing this video, I did some reading, and it's worth taking a minute here to discuss it. Prior to the Super Kamiokande, the various mathematical models predicted that neutrinos should be able to change their flavour over time. This sounds absurd, but is actually explained quite well on the Wikipedia page for neutrino oscillation. There are eigenvalues and connected springs analogies for engineering-minded individuals. It's great. Anyway, that wouldn't be possible if they had zero mass. Anything with zero mass has to travel at the speed of light, and is therefore frozen in time. But the three flavours of neutrino all create different light signatures on the detectors. Remember the atmospheric cascades caused by cosmic rays I mentioned earlier? Those cause a disproportionately high number of muon neutrinos to pass through the detector. So, by observing the relative number of signatures for each flavour over the course of a day, researchers were able to plot out a changing flux as these excess muon neutrinos changed to other flavours as the Earth, and therefore the atmosphere, rotated below the detector. Demonstrating that neutrinos change flavour means they experience time, and that demonstrates they must move slower than the speed of light, and that means they have mass. All that inferred from observing minuscule flashes of light. It's not just me, right? That is absolutely astonishing.
The facility has been so successful that work is nearing completion on its successor, Hyper Kamiokande. This is a scaled-up version of Super Kamiokande, 8.4 times the volume and with 40,000 photomultiplier tubes. That said, you can't change perfection. Hyper Kamiokande will use 50-centimetre tubes just as its predecessor did. Though I imagine engineers will have gone through great efforts to make sure a single tube failing won't knock out the entire experiment. Well, thank you very much for watching, and have a great 2025. I'll be back in February. See you soon.